Welcome to Exploration 1, Lecture 4. I'm not sure what I'm going to call this up on the site, but we'll work that out in a minute. Alrighty. Hey, did anybody see, I saw it on Twitter actually, which is sort of vaguely relevant to this lecture if you sort of, wander down the garden path. Apparently Google deleted like about 150,000 email accounts by accident. That's a little bit disturbing for people.
Yeah, I've actually talked to three people in the last day who it affected. Apparently, some people, today I saw a couple of tweets that I forget who they are from, but apparently some people got their mail back, but for anybody who didn't, it's gone permanently.
And this really brings up a point that I have been making for a long time. And that is, you've got to be aware of the SLAs for your people who are providing you services, even if they're free. Is there any SLA? Is there any guarantee? Because I can imagine that a lot of these people had their lives in their Gmail address books and inboxes, and were quite severely burnt by having all their mail disappear on them. I remember as an ISP, we actually had stuff written into our contract that said that in no way do we guarantee users' message data or their email. We will do our best effort to keep the systems running, but we will not guarantee the safe storage of your your email. Once you have popped that email off the server, it stops being our responsibility. So, interesting times.
I think all ISPs here also have that as a clause that says it's a best effort. They don't guarantee even the network being up all the time either.
Has anybody else been seeing, and I don't know whether it's a transient thing, but has anybody else been seeing 5xx errors from Dropbox when you try to access their website? That's always fun.
They actually put up something and said they were having issues with their service provider and that they were working on.
Interestingly enough, in researching my problem with Internet Explorer, I find that the Microsoft Answer website had a message up there saying they were experiencing problems, and you might make a request and it comes up very quickly, and then the next time you make a request it takes forever and time's out.
Interesting times. I think people have to be a bit careful with the free services they use. Sorry, go ahead.
Also here in South Africa, over the last 48 hours, there's been horrendous connectivity problems. Some of our major banks have actually gone down totally. And they were offline for almost 24 hours.
That's not good at all. Banks tend to be one of those critical bits of infrastructure that everybody sort of expects to work most of the time.
Yeah, we had that at Christmas time, the whole Interact network, which is does all the point-of-sale terminals in the country, went down for like 5 hours, and it was the week before Christmas. And it was top news everywhere, because this caused a major, because all the credit cards go through it too.
Yeah, and I mean, it's not that we actually have any lectures on this specifically in Exploration, but you tend to find that, that system backup plans and stuff need to be looked at. What is your disaster recovery plan? What backups do you have? What are your contingency plans for when things go down in a bad way? And it's certainly something as an IT professional, and there's certainly a network professional that you need to be aware of. If your entire network infrastructure is reliant on one switch that goes bang, you need to be aware of that single point of failure in your network.
I use Gmail, and what I've tended to do is actually use the pop access, and I actually just download all my mail to my machine, so I don't leave it up there on their server. I make sure it's deleted as well.
Okay. I tend to use IMAP, and then I just back up the folder store, which also works. If you keep backups of your folder store, that's you can certainly go into offline mode and pull them back that way as well. Alrighty, I'm going to finish off the bits and pieces we had in chapter 2. Now, has anybody else read Chapter 2 since last week? Anybody read through Chapter 2? I'm probably going to go through it anyway, so it's not really critical, but...
Yep.
Yeah, I managed to read it.
Yeah.
Hurrah! Okay, I'm a much happier person this week. Yeah, no, look, I mean, seriously, guys, if you can pre-read, it'll make your understanding of my lecture a lot easier, especially if you sort of pre-read it and go, and then when I actually get to lecturing it, you'll go, oh, I read that. Oh, yeah, he's saying something about that. It just makes it a bit easier for it to sink in. So, that's good. Okay. So, basically, Chapter 2 deals with, essentially... the layered models. I'll just turn this radio off behind me here. It deals with the OSI reference model, which has... Can anybody tell me how many layers the OSI reference model has? Or type it into chat. I don't care which.
Seven. It does.
Now, I don't know how you guys are going to remember this, and it's not as critical if you're in Discovery, but it is fairly critical if you are in... exploration. You need to know these. This is a core piece of knowledge. I don't know whether you play it on a tape while you go to sleep, or stick it in Braille on the fridge, or whatever method you use for memorizing, but you need to know physical, data link, network, transport, session, presentation, application. Please do not throw sausage pizza away. All people seem to need data processing if you're going the other way. Application, presentation, session, transport, network, data link, physical. I think I got them all. And the only reason I know that so well is because I've been teaching this since 1995. So I've got a bit of an advantage. 95?
I know, it's a pretty teacher.
And Grace knows it because I keep saying it over and over and over again, because it's important. And as we go through these, you'll need to know approximately what these layers do and, you know, what they actually do as far as the networking is concerned, because the entire course is going to hinge your understanding of networking around the OSI reference model. It is the reference model. It is the foundation on which your understanding of how networks function. It's important. It's a reference model. There are no real implementations of the protocol in the real world, specifically OSI compliant stacks. There are none of them in common usage, but it's how we benchmark all the other protocols. How does IPX relate to TCP/IP? How does AppleTalk relate to TCP/IP? That's how we tend to. I just got to end task my copy of Skype, which doesn't seem to want to pop up out of the system tray. This is not good. There we go. Now that Skype has gone, I'm sure my computer has come back. Has anybody noticed that whenever you launch Skype on your netbook, your battery life goes down quite significantly? I don't know what it does, but boy, oh boy, it ups the processor usage on most things I've ever run it on. Alrighty. Now... Sorry, go on. Brian, sorry, I missed that.
Alright, it's not. I have the OSI one. The acronyms work for me. I can sort of remember the layers and have some idea of what they do. It's the TCP model that I struggle a bit more with. I can never remember sort of the mappings between the OSI layers and the TCP layers. I mean, they talk about, for example, an internet layer in the TCP, and I don't quite understand the mapping between that and the OSI model.
Okie dokie. Well, it just so happens that we will be going through that in today's lecture. So today is your lucky day. Well, I suppose that's relative, but it could be your lucky day if that's how you view this, because we will be talking about that today. I think I'm just going to down my sensitivity a smidge. Does it need to go up or down? I never remember. Okay, there we go. All right, so we'll be going through that, and we'll be going through some various other things I've got in the notes here in front of me. Okay, terms to know. Network interface card. Does anybody want to define for me what is a network interface card? Has anybody not seen a network interface card? Anyone here never seen a network interface card in their life?
I think lots of motherboards even have them integrated these days as well.
They certainly do. So does anybody want to have a go at defining what a network interface card does?
All right, I will. Go ahead.
Kerry, I'm getting hideous lag because generally when I say something, it's after like almost 30 seconds I'm hearing it when someone else is actually trying to say something. So I'm not sure if I'm actually talking over people. The network card actually converts into binary, into your bits.
It does. I'm just going to... can somebody tell me what you guys are seeing as a round-trip time on your ping? It's in your main Ventrilo window. You'll have to Jaws cursor for it. I'm seeing 274, which is unusually high. I think somebody may be uploading things to the web server in the middle of lecture. Not happy, Jan.
Happy, Jan. 264.
Okay. 264 is about what I'd expect to see from where you are. I'm seeing 271, and I'm in Perth.
I'm seeing 310.
All right, time to start killing processors with extreme prejudice. Here we go.
Is the web server going to die?
Yeah, and so is the SSH server. That should fix that.
Watch the squeals we'll get.
I've got a number here which is ping 1936.
Oh, that's special.
Wow. Yeah, that's high. That means your packets are taking 2 seconds to get to us.
Yeah, it's gone up to 2365, so yeah.
Okay. Maybe our hosting
I'm going to log out and I'm going to actually reset this thing and then come back on.
Okie dokie, good luck with that.
My ping's running at 277.
Yeah. Okay, that's good. Oh, okay, here we go, I'm back to 75 now. It looks like whatever was transiently upsetting it, I'm now seeing 77, which is about what I should be seeing. You guys should see anywhere between 200 and 400 milliseconds. That's a pretty reasonable, given how far away you are. And in fact, here is an impromptu exercise, because I just thought it might be fun. If you all want to open up a command prompt, and I promise, pinky swear, this will not damage your computer. So Windows R, CMD, or Start Programs Accessories, Command Prompt, or however you would get. I think they've moved it in Windows 7. Where does it live in Windows 7 now? It's somewhere unusual.
Just press your Start menu and type in CMD.
That's what I do, but I think it's actually in... system tools or something now.
Yeah, it is. It's under accessory system tools or something.
I forget the trick to get it.
Yeah, I agree. I forget the trick to get an elevated one, and I needed to do that today, and I couldn't find it very
quickly. Control shift enter.
An elevated one?
And if you're running UAC, you need to get an elevated command prompt with administrator privilege, and you control shift enter on it, and you can run it as an administrator.
Yeah,
I was trying to do power CFG-F or something to make my 4 gigs of hibernation file that I never use go away.
I thought that Windows doesn't hibernate if you've got more than 4 gig of RAM anyway. Like, it just doesn't hibernate.
It may not, but I don't have more than 4. I have 3.6 or something in this machine, or 3.5.
Okay, so what I want everybody to do is to do a TraceRT, which is T-R-A-C-E-R-T, space v47.darkstarllc.com, D-A-R-K-S-T-A-R-L-L-C.com. And no, I'm not copying and pasting that into chat, because if you guys don't type it, you will never learn it. I'm sorry, but if you could copy and paste it out of chat, that would sadly defeat the purpose. I'll put the host name into the chat, but I'm not going to cut and paste the commands in. And there's the host name in chat.
I'm getting unable to resolve. Hang on, I must have spelt it wrong.
It's v47.darkstar, as in a black thing that doesn't shine anymore, LLC, as in Limited Liability Corporation, .com, if that helps.
There we go, that's better.
Okay, now what you're actually going to see from the traceroute output is you're going to see a whole lot of lines. Now, obviously, you can redirect this to a file and look at it more easily, and the way you do that is to press up arrow to pull the command line back and go space greater than outfile.txt or something, which allows you to review the stuff in Notepad. Otherwise, you'll be relegated to JAWS cursoring on your screen for the output. But what I see is the first hop is our default gateway, and that takes a millisecond. Let's see. The next one takes two milliseconds, 3 milliseconds, and 5 milliseconds, respectively, to get to the loopback point at AMCOM. And the next one takes 161 milliseconds. Now, can anybody tell me why are the milliseconds getting larger as the hops increase? Why are the milliseconds getting larger?
Well, your default gateway is local, so you should, I mean, that should take no time to resolve. But you're starting to go over more and more routers on each hop. First, you're hitting your ISP's router, then their default gateway. So it's sort of increasing incrementally in time because it's taking more routers to get to the next stage.
That is exactly right. Okay, has anybody else other than Brian got successful traceroute results to v47.darkstarllc.com?
Took 16 hops from here.
Wow.
11 hops from here, interestingly enough. Okie dokie. Anyone have trouble with the traceroute command? Alrighty. So, terms you need to know. Network interface card is the thing that lets you connect your network card to your network, depending on what sort of media you're using, copper, fiber, wireless. It interfaces your computer to the network that it's connecting to, and it is responsible for placing frames of information, which I'll cover in a minute, onto the medium that you are using. So it works at layer 2 and 1 of the ISR reference model, which is the data link layer and the physical layer. So the program actually hands the Ethernet card frames, and then the Ethernet card is responsible for putting those frames onto the shared media. Now, physical port is obviously where the cable plugs in, and we use this term a lot. A physical port is where you actually, you know, insert the subscriber connector for fiber or plug in the RJ45 network cable or whatever you happen to be plugging in. Now, an interface is a specialized port that connects the device to the internet. It's basically the software abstraction for the physical port. Now, there are actually real interfaces and there are virtual interfaces. And what you can do is you can set up multiple virtual interfaces so that you can have an IP a machine showing up on many different IP addresses. And we used to do that for virtual hosting before we started doing name-based virtual hosting. Okay, now, there are specialized symbols that are used to show what network diagrammy things look like. We actually have some Perspex symbols that you can actually feel that show you what those symbols actually look like. Sadly, it doesn't help the students that are not local. So, did you find the hand sanitizer?
Yeah, I did.
Sorry?
Yeah, I found it.
Have you finished with it?
Yeah,
it's
not on the
ground. The lid wasn't off it, was it?
No.
Okay, good. All right. I don't believe the 2.4 lab is accessible, so I wouldn't worry about it too much. I looked at that one, and it's essentially drawing pictures and stuff in Packet Tracer. 2.2.5, doable. NeoTrace is a bit tricky, but apparently I'm told that you can use Control-Y to look at various bits of information, and you can certainly... get in there with the JAWS cursor and have a look at NeoTrace. Now, NeoTrace is interesting because over and above the regular TraceRoute utility, it actually uses, it actually resolves and finds the locations of various hosts. It tells you what country and stuff they're in, and then actually puts up a map and stuff. So if you can see, that's always a good thing. Has anybody noticed, actually, as an interesting case in point, that if for some reason your GPS is unavailable on your iThing, we're speaking to people who've got iThings here, that it actually uses the IP address of the device or the external IP address of the device for geolocation information. Has anyone seen that?
Yeah, when I first got someone an iPod, I thought, oh, wow, hey, it figured out where we were. We're relatively close to where we were when I opened the Maps application, but it doesn't actually have a GPS. It was doing location resolution based on the IP.
And as a matter of fact, and this is just a general statement, if you were to jailbreak your iPod and install BT Stacker GPS, you can actually hook any external Bluetooth GPS to your iPod, and it suddenly knows exactly where it is, and the Maps application has a far better idea of where you are. With a sub-note that if you don't change the default root password on your jailbroken device, you need your head read, because there are lots of exploits that will SSH into jailbroken devices on the default passwords and toast them for you. And the second thing is that jailbreaking your iDevice voids your warranty. Okay, so just be aware of that. And this is for anybody who's listening to the recordings. All right. Okay, we spoke about protocols last week. We spoke about how that there are rules for communication, there are procedures you need to follow. If you do not follow these particular rules, people get confused. If you're talking about people, people get distressed. I mean, if you think about in everyday life, the protocols that you tend to follow, for example, the protocol of the freight company. You order some goods. The supplier is supposed to provide those goods to the freight company. The freight company is then supposed to provide you with tracking information and deliver those goods to you in a timely fashion. Now, when sections of that protocol break down, it can cause all sorts of trouble for people trying to deal with the ramifications of that. And I think everybody on this channel has had freight problems in their time. Otherwise, if you haven't, you're a lot luckier than me. Now, obviously the protocols are going to differ depending on what sort of communication you're doing. So whether you're doing face-to-face communication, whether you're doing network traffic, whether you are doing diplomacy, whatever, you know, the protocols are obviously going to differ depending on the situation that you find yourself in. My first exposure to the word protocol, ironically enough, was in the movie Star Wars, where C-3PO was stating that he was a protocol droid. That was well and truly before I'd ever built my first Ethernet. Now, a set of protocols that interoperate are called a protocol stack. And we have a number of protocol stacks. We have TCP/IP, we have IPX/SPX, and we have AppleTalk, which has its own protocol stack. There's DECnet, There's ARCNET, there's a few other things. Even Ethernet is a limited sort of protocol stack. Okay, Ethernet... Ethernet suites describe... And our suite... A protocol suite is a series of protocols that interoperate together to get a job done. So, if we look at the TCP/IP protocol suite, you've got all sorts of protocols in there. You've got ARP, you've got TCP, you've got IP, you've got FTP, you've got HTTP, you've got HTTPS, you've got SMTP, DNS. Coming up on the outside, you've got NTP, NNTP, FSP. You get the idea, okay? There's a whole suite of protocols that are defined by what we call request for comments. And you can actually look those RFCs up. They are public documentations. They're pretty dry reading. I have read the odd RFC on occasion to find out how something works. And they are a technical specification of the internet protocols. And you've got requests for comments, you've got IETF or Internet Engineering Task Force drafts, and you've got memos on various things. And interestingly enough, on the April 1st of each year, a joke RFC is published. So if you're bored enough, you can go look through the RFC index and find all the funny ones. Like the infinite number of monkeys on an infinite number of typewriters transposing all of Shakespeare's works. Stuff like that.
They are dry reading, but once in a while...
Go ahead, Brian. They're fairly useful.
One of them that I've actually used fairly extensively, I read the whole SMTP one, and I use it a lot for mail troubleshooting, because what I do is I use Telnet and go in by hand and pretend I'm a mail program and do the whole SMTP transaction, because you can watch all the steps and see what happens, and it can be useful for figuring out what's going wrong with your mail delivery.
Another handy hint that you may not be aware of is OpenSSL space S client can actually be used to do the same thing with secure mail servers. And there are actually commands to actually present the certificate and everything. So that might be worth a play.
That would be useful. I've never known how to do that with a secure server.
I'll see what I can dig up for you, but I actually did see some references that you can do OpenSSL space S client, and you can actually connect to these secure mail servers and provide certificates and actually get the TLS session up and running, and then, you know, talk SMTP over a secure link. So it is possible. Anyone got any questions or queries on any of that stuff so far? On any of the stuff I've raised so far? Okay, silence is golden, and my eyes still don't see. Protocol suites. Describe the format or structure of a message. The method by which networking devices with pathways with other network devices. How and when system error messages are passed across the network. The setup and termination of data transfer sessions. And one of the things I like about this course compared to discovery, and this is just personal preference, but I just really don't take to the whole Thomas the Tank Engine TM style of how, like, all of the routers talk to each other and all the workstations talk to each other, and the router goes, "Ooh, I have 20 packets for you," and the next router says, "Ah, yes, I'm ready to receive that packet, but I didn't get packet 19," and router 1 says, "Ah, I shall send router packet 19 to you again." And I don't know whether anybody's read the Discovery curriculum, but they're into this whole imbue your network devices with a personality, which I'm sure works for a lot of people, but not for me. We have a little bit of that in Exploration, but it's nowhere near as bad as it is in Discovery, and we don't have devices talking to each other, because that would certainly make a noisy machine room. Okay. Individual protocols in a protocol suite may be vendor-specific and proprietary. This is to say that they are owned by someone, or you have to pay somebody a license to use certain protocols, or you have to pay somebody for the use of that protocol. Can anybody give me an example of a vendor proprietary protocol that operates within the TCP/IP protocol suite? No. Sorry, QuickTime is not a protocol. How about Skype? I would say Skype's protocols are pretty vendor proprietary. The protocols that Skype uses to do its voice transmission. For your reference, QuickTime actually uses RTP as its streaming transport, which is an open standard. The actual contents of the RTP payload are very proprietary, but the actual protocol that's used to do the streaming is actually open.
Does Skype not use sort of standard protocols to do its... at some point it's got to interface with TCP, I guess, yeah, but the actual packet headers and stuff are some proprietary thing that no one else has.
Yeah, it certainly uses TCP and UDP. If you actually look at a Skype conversation, it uses... And this is an interesting case in point. And I'll mention this because it's worth mentioning here, because we try to make these lectures useful. If you have... does anybody remember when Skype melted down a few months ago? It just died for about 2 or 3 days. All their supernodes fell over. So when the supernodes fell over, the Skype network collapsed. And the thing you've got to understand about Skype is that if you've got a few people behind what we call network address translators, which are devices that allow multiple devices behind the NAT to share one IP address, you end up with a situation where devices can't talk to each other, and to actually talk to each other they need to relay their traffic through a third-party relay. Now, if you have Skype and your NAT device does not understand NAT-PMP or UPnP. There we go, just using the chat because that's probably going to be more reliable. So if you actually have these super nodes, they actually relay stuff between the different nodes, and that's how Skype's able to communicate. If your network address translator doesn't understand NAT-PMP or Universal Plug and Play, it is advantageous for you to forward the Skype port that your Skype is using, both TCP and UDP, through your firewall. And this will allow the Skype stuff to actually communicate directly with the person you are talking to, which will greatly reduce your latency, and it will also reduce the number of call dropouts you experience. I'm seeing pings of 308 again.
Odd.
It is time to chuck up in a net stat, I think. Let's have a look.
That's not bad.
No, it's been fairly constant.
Somebody's got piles of IMAP connections open to this.
To
the QCAT server. Somebody's got IMAP open to the KubeCat server from inside the association network. How come you just logged off? You closed the wrong window.
I did, me too. I got
a thing out. Grace will be back soon. No, it's not coming from here. I think I've got to check with Kieran in case he's got connections open to the server. It's alright. Nah, it's alright. Alrighty. Now, so as I was saying, the actual internal guts of Skype, nobody really knows except for Skype how that behaves. It's a fairly proprietary protocol. So now they've got gateways to actually gateway Skype into VoIP PABXs and stuff. That previously wasn't possible. But Skype realized that if they didn't somehow interoperate with the regular VoIP market, they would lose a lot of business, and they weren't going to be able to leverage their VoIP platform if it couldn't interoperate with things such as the commercially available VoIP exchanges or things like Asterisk. And has anybody other than Brian here ever played with Asterisk? I wouldn't expect too many other people would have.
I have at some stage.
Ah, excellent. There's actually a few nice versions of Asterisk. There's a new one called PBX in a Flash, which now sets itself up very quickly, and it's basically almost an automatic install. If you go KS Auto at the boot prompt, it will actually give you a working PBX with no user input. It'll come up and work. So that's worth playing with. And then when you get it up, it's all a web interface to configure it. The other one I saw that was quite good was... there's actually a micro distribution of PABX that runs on a whole stack of the routers and stuff, and I just can't remember what it's called. So we'll move on, but I'll look it up on VoIP-info and get back to everybody. But Asterisk, for anybody who doesn't know, is some software that will allow you to run a voice over IP PABX with voicemail, call on hold, ring queues, the whole works. And it works very well once it's correctly configured. Okay, any questions on anything I've raised so far? Alrighty. Now, the other thing they're saying in the notes is that protocols can be technology independent if they actually define what needs to be done rather than how it's actually done. So, for example, if the protocol says wait 2 seconds for an acknowledgement, and it doesn't say how that can be done, it means that the waiting for 2 seconds can be done on wireless networks, fiber networks, or Ethernet. But if the protocol, for example, says wait 2 million clock cycles for an acknowledgement, then the protocol becomes technology dependent because we're expecting the clocks and the hardware to run at a certain speed. Now, this is important because the same number of, the same type of frame is transmitted on Ethernet all the way from 10 megabit half duplex coaxial cable to 10 gig copper. It's the same frame layout, and it's just other aspects of the actual transmission speed and stuff that change. Now the notes have a section here on the benefits to layered models. It assists in protocol design because you can actually have protocols set up at a specific design that work at that do specific things. So you've got things that work at the transport layer, you've got things that work at the data link layer, and those protocols can be specific to those layers. They also talk to the layers above and below them. You can get competition because stuff from different vendors can work together. You can prevent technology changes in one layer from affecting layers above and below. Now that really comes back to the example I gave of the same frame format being on 10 megabit Ethernet as to the same frame format used on 10 gig Ethernet. And it also provides common language to describe networking functions and capabilities. Now, if you've seen these list of bullet points in the notes that you guys have been reading, have a lollipop, because that's where I pulled my notes from. Unless, of course, you're not allowed to have lollipops, then have something else. Now, the protocol model... the protocol model shows stuff that you actually need to get stuff to work, and the actual reference model shows all the other stuff that goes into it. So, for example, the TCP TCP IP model shows what's actually going on as far as stuff on the internet, and the OSI reference model has some other stuff that goes on top of that that it shows, and bureaucracy stuff that's in there. Okay, no questions so far? Okay, protocols have the following steps. So you get the application data created at the application layer of the source device. So say, for example, we're sending a mail to somebody, okay, like an email. So you have segmentation and encapsulation. In other words, the message is broken up into smaller units, and it has headers and trailers, in some cases, wrapped around that information. So that's your encapsulation. And those things are packetized up, ready to go over the network. You then have the generation of the data onto the media at the network access layer of the stack. The transportation of the data through the network, so which consists of media and any intermediary devices such as routers, hubs, switches, repeaters, etc. The reception of the data at the network layer of the receiving device. The decapsulation and reassembly of the data so that it turns up the same way on the receiving device as it did on the sending device. And passing the data to the application layer and the application that is listening at the destination. Now, it's worth mentioning here that these layers and these layers and stuff are a logical concept. There's not actually, you're not going to sort of walk into a comms room and trip over a data link box, or you're not going to walk into a session layer demulticapsulator. Okay? The session layer is there, but it is it's a virtual layer, it's a virtual concept, it's not actually a physical thing you can kick or throw things at. Okay, now as the stuff is sent through the OSI reference model, it goes through things that we call PDUs, or protocol data units. The protocol data units are called different things depending on which layer of the OSI reference model they exist at. Now, I'm telling you, this is in your test somewhere, I think. I'm pretty sure one of the chapter tests actually covers, gets you to put all the PDUs in order. So here we go. The data is the general form of the PDU at the application layer. Stuff comes in as data. Segments is the transport layer PDU. So if you're looking at TCP/IP, you're looking at the segments of TCP/IP happen at the transport layer. Packet is the inter-network PDU. In other words, that's the one that happens at the network layer. That's the one where you route packets. You don't route segments, you route packets, and the packets get routed. Frame is the network access layer PDU, so we're dealing with the frames that would exist on a fiber link or the frames that would exist on a wireless link. For example, people may not be aware of this, but whilst the regular MTU of Ethernet is generally 1,536 bytes, the regular MTU of a wireless network is actually 2,346 bytes. So obviously they are the maximum sizes of the frames you can have on those media. And bits is the PDU that is used when physically transmitting data over the medium. Okay, everybody cool with those PDUs? Alrighty, here we go through all of the different layers of the OSI reference model and what they do. I'm just looking at my ping again. Ah, it's actually down to 76, which is always pleasant. Always good to have a braille display for this stuff. And not that it really matters, but when you actually talk, it actually puts dash XMIT dash next to the ping, so you can actually see when you're transmitting.
Where is that? I'm looking on my braille display frantically as we speak here, and I don't see it. Maybe I'm not looking in the right place.
Keep in mind you've got to be in the Ventrilo window, and I think if I remember correctly, you've got a JAWS cursor up towards the ping, otherwise it doesn't show up properly. You've actually got to go from the bottom of the window, because it doesn't show up properly if you go from the top.
I must say, the ping seems to be coming down here. Now it got down to 700.
Ah, well, that's somewhat better. I have no idea what the pings over your wireless network would normally be, because I don't think we've actually benchmarked it previously. Okay. The application layer provides the means for end-to-end connectivity. Applications talk to the application layer. The presentation provides for common representation of the data, so character set, encoding, that sort of thing. The session layer provides stuff to the presentation layer to organize the communication into sessions and to manage data exchange. And the transport layer defines... Actually, I should be using the Braille display to do this because it'll be easier. We'll move the jam, the bag for the jam donuts out of the way. Layer 4, transport. The transport layer defines services to segment, transfer, and defines... and you're not going to scroll, all right? And reassemble the communications for data between devices. The network layer provides services to exchange the individual pieces of data over the network to various devices. And the data link layer is the one that exchanges the data over the between devices on a common media. So that's how you get your packets around on Ethernet, that's how you get your packets around on fiber, etc. It does not cover how you get data from, say, one different type of network to the other. And the physical layer defines the electrical, mechanical, and functional and procedural means to actually activate the data transfer over a particular media. Ah, so time to figure out why my ALVA display isn't scrolling in Notepad after lecture. Okay, and here we go, the TCP/IP OSI comparison. Okay.
Are you still in JAWS cursor mode?
Without actually hitting the PC cursor button, I don't know of an easy way to tell. No, I'm in PC cursor mode, because the pitch hasn't dropped. I'd say active isn't set to follow Braille or something goofy. But anyway, we'll sort that later. Okay, so here is the comparison between the TCP/IP model and the OSI reference model. Okay, so layer 7 in the OSI relates to layer 4 in the TCP/IP model, which is the application layer. The layer 6 in the OSI relates to layer 4 in the TCP. So we've got presentation, session, session, presentation, and application all relate to layer 4 of the TCP/IP model, which is application. Now, if you're looking for this, it's actually towards the end of chapter 2 is where they actually have the mappy bit. Okay, so OSI layer 4 transport maps directly to the TCP/IP transport layer, which is layer 3. And that is the one that deals with segmenting and data reassembly and ordering. Okay, so the internet layer relates to the TCP/IP internet layer. Okay, so the networking layer of the OSI reference model relates to the TCP/IP internet layer, and that's the one that is responsible for routing the individual packets from, you know, Guam to America via Berlin. Okay, that's the internet / network layer. And the data link layer and the physical both relate to layer 1 of the TCP/IP model, which is network access. Any questions on that?
Yeah, in the notes, now it may have been in the chapter 3 notes, but they say that POP operates in the TCP model at the presentation layer, where SMTP operates at the routing layer or at the network layer, and I don't really understand that because they're both sort of transaction to get end user data from A to B.
I wouldn't necessarily agree with that. Actually, I'm sort of with you on that. SMTP would operate at the application layer, if you asked me, because it is an application process, although there are aspects of mail delivery that utilize DNS information, which is where it gets a bit fuzzy, and that's why we don't always see things map cleanly to the OSI reference model, because it's a bureaucratic crock that we all have to map everything to. So You will tend to find... Can I send you out to get me some water, please?
Yep.
Thank you. Here you are. Oh, there we go. Okie dokies. So, I wouldn't have said that POP... I would have said POP sort of works up at the application layer of the TCP/IP model and that sort of thing. So, I will have a read of Chapter 3 and see if I agree with that. Alrighty, any questions apart from that one that Brian's obviously raised that we've kind of dealt with until we get into Chapter 3? Anything else pending? Anyone still following me? Or am I making no sense at all? Follow me! Hoorah! Okay. It pays to check. Because, you know, I'd hate to get sort of see all these messages on, you know, Cavi Disfast that says, wow, you should have seen the big load of crud that today's exploration lecture was. Can anybody explain? Not that I think any of you would actually do that, but, you know, it's a humorous thing. I'd like to make sure that people are sort of keeping track of where we're up to. Alrighty. Now, obviously, devices need various types of addressing. You've got various addresses that exist at various layers of the model. You have... can anybody tell me what type of address exists at the data link layer or layer 2? Just be careful you don't walk into your chair, Grace. I'm over here. Beep, beep, beep. MAC addresses! And can anybody tell me who might know, except for Brian, who definitely knows, so you're not answering this one. Does anybody know how long a MAC address is? How many bits are in a MAC address? No, I'm sorry, that is incorrect. There are not 20 bits in a MAC address. Try again, or somebody else can have a go. There are 48 bits in a MAC address. MAC addresses are written as... there are 20 characters in a MAC address. There are 20 characters, but I asked how many bits were in a MAC address, so my bad. I asked a complicated question. There are 20 characters in a MAC address. You have... no, there aren't. I can't add up. There aren't, you know. I'm trying to work it out now. There's
18.
There's 18.
18 if you include the colons.
Yeah, okay, so there are not 20. All right. Just thought I might have been able to give you sort of half the answer there, but apparently not. There'd be 20 if you put a space on either side. Okay, we're really grasping at straws here. If you look at the MAC address, they are actually pairs of hexadecimal digits separated by colons or dots, generally speaking. Some run them all up together. Some of them actually have dots and colons separating them. And there are 6 pairs of hexadecimal digits, giving us 12 hexadecimal digits, which uniquely identify the computer on the network. The first 3 bytes of the MAC address, or the first 24 bits, are the organizational unique identifier, which defines who makes the network card. 3Com, Cisco, Realtek, Asus. Now, if my memory serves me and you actually fire up a copy of Wireshark and use the JAWS cursor, if it knows, it will actually show you the vendors of the Ethernet cards as the packets come in. Okie dokie. So MAC addresses at layer 2. Anybody give me an example of a type of network address that exists at layer 3 of the OSI reference model? Or at the network layer of the TCP model. IP address. Alrighty.
Do you need one?
No, that's fine. Now, a port number specifies the application that is using a particular protocol. So, to be able to multiplex multiple application communications over a single piece of network media, the system of TCP/IP, for example, uses what we call a port number, both a source port and a destination port. The reason you do this is so that you don't have instant messages popping up in a web page or Skype packets showing up in the middle of an email. You obviously want those separated off and partitioned off by using the port numbers. And we will cover port numbers extensively in a future lecture. Okay, anybody got any questions? Because that's all we have for today. That is the end of chapter 2.